Welcome to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. We're well into the holiday season, during which the thoughts of most of us turn to festive gatherings marking some of the most religious events on the calendar. But it's also a time for debutante balls, for at least a few of our nation's more socially prominent families. So what's the history of these balls? Where do they originate and how have they changed over the years? That's the subject of Talking History's Lena Places conversation this week with Carol Ann Marling, the author of Debutante, Rites and Regalia of American Debden. Following that, Kelly Schrum tells us about a site where we can learn more about the history of a line of products that many debutantes have used over the years, Tupperware. And Michael Farquhar will offer up the fourth in his 10-part series drawn from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do every week, let's take a look at a few items of historical interest in the news that you may have missed. Following up on an article in the news we reported on several weeks ago, that historians have discovered that George Washington housed as many as 9 slaves in the presidential mansion he occupied in Philadelphia, a committee has been appointed to oversee the creation of a monument to those slaves. The committee, made up of historians, community activists, and members of Congress, will seek public input for the memorial and select its final design. The project is expected to be completed by July 4, 2007. Which is appropriate, as it'll be located just steps away from the Liberty Bell. Washington and John Adams lived at the site during the years Philadelphia was the nation's capital, from 1790 to 1800. But the actual house was torn down in the 1830s. In 2002, Congress directed the National Park Service to build the monument, but delays followed when historians could not agree on the building's exact location. That's now been worked out, and the project will proceed with a price tag in excess of $5 million. And some very valuable photographs have been found in the trash, of all places. In the late 1960s, Bill Hendry rescued 30 photographs of Oklahoma migrants from a garbage bin at the San Jose Chamber of Commerce. His family had come from Oklahoma, and he could relate to the photos. Over the next 40 years, aside from several attempts by his wife to return them to the trash, the photos were mostly forgotten. Hendry's daughter, Marion Tankersley, recently rediscovered them when she was emptying her parents' house after their deaths. She contacted experts who confirmed her suspicions that they are original prints made by the renowned photographer Dorothea Lange. Among them is Migrant Mother, perhaps the most famous photograph taken during the Great Depression that came to symbolize that era. The photos are documents of a difficult time in American history, commented Christopher Mahoney, a vice president of Sotheby's photography department who was among the first to view the collection. But also, he added, in a lot of instances, they transcend their own time and place and speak universally of the human condition. When we return, Lena Place talks to Carol Ann Marling about a quite different representative of the human condition, the debutante. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
During the next few weeks, in many parts of the country, dances and parties, balls, if you will take place presenting yet another group of young women to society as debutantes. For many of us, it's a strange, even anachronistic event, but it has a fascinating history. And here to explore that history is Talking History's Lena Place and her guest, Carol Ann Marling.
In spring, a young woman's thoughts turn to other things, proms and June weddings, and for a very few, a presentation to society, usually referred to as her debut. Our guest today, Professor Carol Ann Marling, has explored the rites and rituals of the debut season in her book, Debutante. Professor Marling teaches art history and American studies at the University of Minnesota and is the author of many books on American culture and iconography. Welcome, Carol Ann.
Morning.
Well, let's begin with perhaps the obvious question. What does the experience of a very few young women, part of society's elite, have to say about America today?
Well, that's a good one. In a way, it says that there is an American elite, and it's very small, and very few young women indulge in it. I was lecturing about a year ago at a very exclusive Ivy League school on the East Coast, and during the course of my talk said that I was working on debutantes, and was anybody in the room a debutante? And there was just a universal lack of interest in answering. So I went off to have a cup of coffee in the campus eatery, and one by one, young women began slinking up to me and saying, well, I really was a debutante, but, you know, it's a very private thing, and I certainly don't want my friends to know about it. If we have an elite in America today, it's not splashing its name in general across the front pages of the papers, at least in the northern half of the United States. We don't find debuts covered in the New York Times, for example, which used to be one of the main purveyors of society news. Maybe in some very small cities we might find mention of debuts in the newspaper, but it's pretty much an elite ritual because it's celebrated by elites.
And so much has changed, as your book documents, that the young women you were talking to would have been less than thrilled about admitting that they were debs is indeed something that has changed. You begin your book with a discussion of the social scene in the late 1800s. What was that about America in those days with American women, the changing role of American women, that made them so eager to bring forth their daughters in a formal debut?
Well, part of the reason I think that the debut scene became such a splashy one in the late 1800s was because of money. And that is, lots of people suddenly had it who hadn't before. The Civil War just coughed up millionaires aplenty. And these were people with some reason to be slightly suspicious of roués and cads who might insinuate themselves into the affections of their daughters. So a debut was a way of setting the boundaries of a given social set. For people who hadn't made a lot of money during the Civil War but had names that went back to the colonial era, the debut served another function, and that was to assert the hegemony of blood in American life. So, interestingly enough, we often find the aristocracy of blood and the aristocracy of money coming together under the banner of the debut.
Was there some tension between those two groups, at least initially? New money, old name?
There was in the beginning the famous case of Mrs. Astor for years refusing to recognize Mrs. Vanderbilt, an upstart, until their daughters decided to become friends and dance a cotillion together, at which point Mrs. Astor had to capitulate and recognize Mrs. Vanderbilt for the first time. Moms were crucially involved in this whole process, I might add, and this is kind of important because if the men were out making money and doing the usual vulgar things men do, the women were in charge of a kind of taming the drawing room, determining what the rules of conduct were to be in a social setting. And it was they who largely staged managed their daughters' presentations to society, and it gave them considerable social prestige that they would not otherwise have had, and visibility. It's no accident that the early suffragists were mostly women of noble or rich birth who had gone through this debuting experience. They had learned how to be public figures.
An amazing contradiction, I think, in terms of our modern perceptions of those suffragettes.
Absolutely.
The early debuts that you're describing in the book were often linked to presentations at the English court, Queen Victoria, presumably. Why were 19th century Americans so obsessed with that kind of glamour and ritual, something that they had rejected just 100 years before?
Well, that's one of the wonderful things about the East Coast of the United States. Scratch a Yankee and you're going to find a grand lover of the British monarchy. It's really only the Irish who have had the good sense to put that nonsense aside when they emigrated to the United States. One of the things that's interesting about making your debut at the Court of St. James, as it was called, was that you could kind of slip into society that way. Suppose you'd had a rough time back in New York or Boston or Baltimore being accepted by the greats of your neighborhood. You could always make a political donation to the reigning political party, get yourself in good with the current ambassador to the Court of St. James, and of course that's always been a wildly political appointment based on money, and then you could be dragged in front of Queen Victoria or one of her loutish successors, and as it was said at the time, make the bow. There were all sorts of wonderful, mysterious, arcane rules about how long your veil could be and where you should stand and what you should eat, what kind of carriage you should take to get there, which, of course, added an aura of tremendous excitement and mystery to the whole procedure. Even people like Teddy Roosevelt's daughter Alice wound up being presented at the Court of St. James. She never thought her own stepmother gave her a decent debut at the White House because her stepmother wouldn't allow champagne to be served. She did not approve of drunkenness in young people.
You record this wonderful transition from rather private, genteel family teas to very public extravaganzas. When did debutantes become celebrities?
Well, they really became celebrities that people talked about on an everyday basis with, I suppose, Consuela Vanderbilt, the unfortunate daughter of the very woman I was mentioning earlier, who was actually sold off by her father to a chinless British aristocrat and had, you know, a terribly unhappy marriage and fortunately got out of it later. But that was one of the beginnings when ordinary people would stand outside Delmonico's Hotel, which was the scene of many of these events, with their noses pressed to the windows because they had never seen such displays of wealth before. When the newspapers got a hold of this, and later magazines and publicists in a big way, was really the late 1920s and the 1930s. And there's something just ever so slightly repellent about the thought of people out of work, their own children without enough to eat, the New Deal frantically trying to hold the nation together, and some little snip of a 17-year-old out nightclubbing in a strapless gown, having middle-aged suitors chasing her all over town, and all of this not only being reported in the newspapers and the magazines, but being pumped up with a veneer of glamour. On the other hand, it's always fun to watch the antics of the rich and famous when you're not, and to kind of aspire in that direction. And people like Brenda Frazier, who was really a not very interesting or important little girl, was treated in this way as one of America's first stars. Now, when you consider that today we're doing the same thing, we do it on so-called reality shows, we do it on American Idol. You just pluck somebody out of the neighborhood and turn them into a star, even though they're pretty ordinary. That's sort of what this was all about.
And they then became characters in movies and books?
Yes, they did.
Very popular at the time.
Very soignée sort of figures. They all smoked cigarettes in holders. They were frightfully thin. They toyed with men and tossed them aside as though they were used handkerchiefs. They became stock figures, really, of the American stage and screen.
Katharine Hepburn in The Philadelphia Story, of course, is the one who comes to mind.
Except, of course, Katharine Hepburn is tough as nails. And I don't know that you'd want to mess with her. She's no dreamy-headed debutante.
Not at all.
Although she was a debutante, of course.
You have some just fascinating chapters in the book talking about how African-American and Latino young women, groups not traditionally associated with the debutante experience, are now coming out. What's happening there?
Well, latent in this whole debutante experience was the idea that when you came out, your parents were essentially saying that you were ready to achieve a mature place in society, that you knew how to run a household, that you knew how to behave yourself, that you were going to be a credit to your family and your community. And that's precisely the notion that minority communities have picked up on over the past 40 or 50 years, that they are presenting to a community a polished and finished young person who's ready to take her rightful place in a leadership role in that community. This is particularly true of black debutantes, and there are societies, particularly in Detroit and in Savannah, that go way back to the 1930s and 40s, and they see debuting as a preparation for a new generation to assume a place of importance in the community. In the Latino community, young girls are often put through a ritual at the age of 15 that has caused some controversy, particularly in the American Southwest. There's always been a religious component to that ritual, and some priests have charged that the ritual is really all about sexual availability, that it's not, in fact, about maturity, that the girls are too young. I think I would argue against that these days, because most young girls seem more mature than I at the age of 11. It also shows that this ritual has been democratized in a real way. Almost anybody with the grit to become a deb can, with nuances, I guess I would say.
And you argue towards the end of the book that the prom, the experience that most of us have had, is actually a democratic debut for many of America's young girls.
Yeah, it certainly was for me in those naive days when your junior prom, I suppose, was the first time you wore high heels and the first time you had a good dress that showed your shoulders off, etc. I will never forget the nuns giving us precise measurements as to the distance from your collarbone to the top of your dress and threatening us that if we went one nano inch past that, that they were going to sew a table napkin into the front of the dress in front of God and everybody. So I've never quite gotten over prom. But it's a delight to go to the mall on a spring weekend and watch young girls coming in there in their scruffies and transforming themselves into these beautiful young things. And it's fascinating, too, to watch young men who are far more conscious of their appearance, certainly, than they once were, crowding into tux shops and trying to coordinate their powder blue tuxedos with the gown that their young woman is wearing. What I like about it is that this is a self-created right. Little by little, moms and nuns, I might add, have been excluded from this ritual, and it's something that the young people do for themselves. And watching them make the choices that they ultimately make is fascinating, because it says something about them and not particularly or exclusively about their family aspirations or about group aspirations or anything like that. And they do seem to be having a lot of fun doing this.
One final question. You've talked about your prom experience. Have you ever attended a debut, a formal cotillion?
I think that's a secret between myself and the social register.
Very good. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
The Debutante Ball, an anachronism or a profound statement about the often conflicting aspirations of Americans to be both democratic and elite. Professor Marlene's richly described book again reminds us that America's social history provides insights to our most complex issues and experiences. We have been speaking to Carol Ann Marling, author of Debutante, Rights and Regalia of American Debden. This is Talking History.
Someday, when I'm awfully low, when the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight. But you're lovely, with your smile so warm, and your cheeks so soft, there is nothing for me but to love you just the way you look tonight.
As a follow-up to our interview with Carol Ann Marling, we couldn't resist offering you directions to a fascinating site where you can learn much more about the history of one of the most common household items in the nation, Tupperware. Here to tell you about it is Kelly Schrum, Assistant Director of the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University.
N.W. from Columbus, Ohio, shares her feelings about Tupperware. My story is one that could be told by countless others across America. It was 1955. I was a new bride and about to become a mother. If it weren't for my selling Tupperware, we would never have been able to own a home right away or furnish it with new furniture. We have four successful children, all college educated, thanks to Tupperware sales. Thank you, Tupperware, for helping to make our American dream come true. This site explores the invention and rise of Tupperware products in the 1950s, as well as their impact on women's issues and connection to the 20th century consumer culture revolution. The site focuses on Earl Tupper, the inventor of Tupperware, and Brownie Wise, the woman who created the Tupperware party concept and built a Tupperware empire. In the gallery, visitors can look at 12 of Tupper's invention notebooks to see some less successful ideas, such as the no-drip ice cream cone and the necktie shaper. The teacher's guide offers learning activities. A timeline spans from the 1850s to 2003 and includes the invention of plastic. Primary sources include transcripts of interviews with Tupper and Wise, excerpts from the first Tupperware handbook, and six video clips from the late 1950s and early 1960s documenting the annual Tupperware homecoming jubilees, which were large gatherings of Tupperware dealers. Also included are six documents, including a 1960s training manual, How to Sell Tupperware, and a collection of Wise's aphorisms. Visitors can share their experiences with Tupperware, either as consumers or as Tupperware dealers, in the Share Your Story section. Finally, the site features an interview with noted historian Elaine Tyler May, who discusses the realities of employment for married women in the 1950s, as well as the impact of Tupperware on opportunities for women. To locate this site, visit historymatters.gmu.edu. Type Tupperware into the keyword search.
Finally, we continue our series of readings from Michael Farquhar's new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. Farquhar is a writer and editor for The Washington Post. And this week, he selected a piece from Part 4 of his book, State-Sponsored Deceptions, which he has titled Presidential Lies.
Legend has it that George Washington never told a lie. Although that's an impossible standard for any man to meet, at least the first president had the goods to inspire such a myth. Few of his successors could claim similar virtue. Presidents are politicians, after all, and thus not always willing to let the truth stand in the way of an agenda. This has most often been the case when the commander-in-chief wants war. In 1846, James K. Polk stood before Congress and declared that Mexico posed an immediate threat to the United States. Foreign troops, he said, had crossed the border and shed American blood upon the American soil. It wasn't true. Mexico had not invaded, but had clashed with U.S. troops on disputed land occupied by Mexican civilians. In fact, the only real threat Mexico represented was that it stood in the way of American manifest destiny. Though Polk got his war, his claims were disputed throughout the conflict by a young congressman from Illinois named Abraham Lincoln, who challenged the president to show him the spot on U.S. soil where American blood had been shed. Though branded a traitor in some circles, Lincoln was mostly ignored. The United States was winning the war, ultimately gaining an enormous swath of new territory, and no one was overly eager to question why it started. A number of 20th century presidents were equally dishonest about their foreign entanglements. President Dwight Eisenhower told the nation that a U-2 spy plane shot down over the Soviet Union was actually a research airplane conducting weather experiments. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev proved him a liar when he produced the pilot of the plane. Eisenhower was humiliated, and the episode was an enduring blot on his administration. His successor, John F. Kennedy, agreed to a secret plan to back anti-communist exiles in an invasion of Cuba with the aim of overthrowing Fidel Castro. Just before the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion, however, the president pledged in a news conference that U.S. forces would not intervene in Cuba under any circumstances. President Lyndon Johnson told the nation in 1964 that U.S. destroyers had been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of North Vietnam. What he neglected to say was that there were serious doubts in the White House as to whether the attack had even occurred. Nevertheless, a resolution was passed in Congress to escalate the use of force in Vietnam. 9 years later, more than 58,000 Americans had died, and more than 300,000 were wounded.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception: Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. That's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thanks for listening. This is your host, Brian Laveau.